will try and exert, somehow wield greater influence in Libya. That said, many of the NATO countries already wield, were already very much involved in Libya, deeply embedded in Libyan, the Libyan economy under the Gaddafi regime. And NATO countries continue to wield influence in Egypt and Tunisia as well. And where this is very different from Iraq, I think is important to stress, and people said this to me over and over again in Libya when I asked if they were worried that Libya is going to become Iraq or Afghanistan. They said this was a popular uprising. It was a mass revolt. It was not a foreign invasion to overthrow a leader. Furthermore, you don't have NATO countries sort of functioning as the executive authority of Libya. You have Libyans in charge. You don't have a coalition provisional authority or a figure like Paul Bremer dealing with the day-to-day activities, day-to-day governance of Libya. And this sort of future scenario is something that people in Libya would be very much against. In terms of expanding the sphere of influence, sure, that's something that people are concerned about and will try and limit to the extent that's possible. But this is also a reality in, you know, across North Africa, certainly in Egypt, Tunisia, Morocco.
Anjali, we want to thank you so much for being with us, and we look forward to playing your reports next week as you crossed Libya to bring the voices of Libyans to a global audience. Thanks so much, Democracy Now! Correspondent Anjali Kamat, just back from Libya, speaking to us from Cairo, Egypt. Nermeen?
Mahmoud, you talked about some of the anxieties in Africa regarding this intervention, and today there's a meeting in Pretoria, South Africa, of the African Union. Can you say a little bit about why the African Union hasn't recognized the interim authority of the National Transitional Council, even though individual members have, and whether this meeting might lead to such recognition?
Well, the African Union is in deep crisis itself. Without the vote of two of its leading members, South Africa and Nigeria, there would have been no UN intervention, no NATO intervention. And they know it. Having voted in favor of that intervention, now they are crying foul and saying that our efforts to mediate were ignored. So they appear like just a useless body, a gathering where people can air their grievances, but nothing more than that. So they have to salvage themselves. The reluctance to recognize the transitional government in Libya is an admission that they don't see an easy way out of this dilemma. So they will have to recognize it. If not today, then tomorrow. Their problem is, you know, they have sat through a series of crises over the last few years. You had Ivory Coast, equally divided society. The Mbeki initiative on Ivory Coast was basically about getting the two sides to talk to one another. Maybe even a kind of solution that was found in Kenya, because think of it. Kenya, after the election, was very similar to Ivory Coast. The government in power had lost the election. The opposition was crying foul, right? Similar to Ivory Coast. And yet, the UN and the US solution was not to throw that government out, but actually to force the opposition to enter into an alliance whereby the government kept on being the government. And the opposition was simply ensured that the next time round there would be a free election. So, why not in Ivory Coast? You know, the rules are changing from country to country depending on the interests involved. So the African Union is sort of irrelevant.
Speaking of countries, I wanted to talk about the newest nation in the world, South Sudan. July 11th of this year, tens of thousands celebrated South Sudan as the country became the world's newest independent state. South Sudan won its independence from Sudan in a January referendum, the climax of a 2005 peace deal that ended decades of fighting with the North. While North Sudan was the first nation to recognize the new state, many issues remain unresolved between the two nations, including disputes over borders and oil payments. I want to play a comment from South Sudan's first president, Salva Kiir. He's the former military commander of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement.
A happy day like this should not dwell on the bad memories, but it is important to recognize that For many generations, this land has seen untold suffering and death. We have been bombed, maimed, enslaved, and treated worse than a refugee in our own country. But we have to forgive, although we will not forget.
The president of the new nation of South Sudan, Professor Mahmoud Mamdani, your response. You've written extensively about this. Were you there on July 11th?
No, I wasn't there. Look, I'm not very optimistic about what is likely to follow over the next few years. And the main reason is this. The SPLA was very successful under Garang. And the reason it was successful is because it shed the program of an independent South Sudan and called for a new Sudan. So by adopting an all Sudan strategy, it was able to win over allies in the north. And the allies it won were precisely the border states, which are now in trouble. When the SPLM went for an independent South Sudan strategy, these border states in the north opposed it. They felt that they were being betrayed. They had joined the struggle with the SPLM, and now they were being left to the wolves being the military in the north. Independence has come. South Sudan is independent. It's a sovereign country with borders. But the South Sudanese military, the SPLA, is integrated with the militias and different forces inside border states in the north. Okay. Now, what are they going to do? Right. These forces on the ground feel a sense of loyalty to the cause of the people in the Nuba Mountains, the people in South Kordofan, the people in Blue Nile. So you have basically a conflict, no longer simmering. You have an active conflict in these border states, which has two dimensions to it. One dimension is an internal revolt, a popular revolt, and the other dimension is the involvement of what are now foreign forces. Okay, this is the question that North Sudan has brought to the Security Council, right? But this is a worse situation than Ethiopia and Eritrea, because at least in the Ethiopian Eritrean case, you had forces on two sides of the border. You had Eritreans inside Ethiopia, but they were all civilians, right? It began with an expulsion of all the Eritreans and then a confrontation of armed forces. You have, nobody knows the figures, but at least a million South Sudanese in the north today. So shall we expect an expulsion in the coming months, and then shall we expect a military confrontation? Difficult to say, but I'm not very optimistic.
Mahmoud, I want to turn now to the decade since 9/11. You wrote Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, about the relationship between the Cold War and what happened subsequent to it, including the 9/11 attacks and now the war on terror. So I just want to play a comment from this weekend's 9/11 commemoration ceremony at the Pentagon. U.S. Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta said the United States will never stop fighting those who were responsible.
To this day, and by these memorials to each victim, we pledge to never forget the enemy that made this happen, why we fight them, and why we will never stop fighting them to make sure that what happened here in New York City and in that field in Pennsylvania never happens again.
Mahmoud, your comments?
Well, the problem is defining who they intend to fight. Because those who carried out the attacks on 9/11 were not a state. They were not an army, navy, or air force. There have been two wars since then, wars of choice, against existing states. nobody believes and nobody claims anymore that these were involved in the fighting. So this has just become a blank check for what looks more and more like a rogue state to go around fighting whoever wants to fight. But I think the more serious question is its impact on American society itself. There is a huge problem at home. I mean, you know, one out of every six Americans is poor. Popular programs, welfare programs are being cut. The Cold War ended. The Soviet Union reformed in some ways. The losing side has to reform, right? It's the winning side which doesn't reform. And it hasn't reformed. And this is a program for not reforming. This is a program for continuing the militarization of the U.S.
So you see the poverty as a direct consequence of these wars that have been waged since 9/11?
Well, I see the poverty not as a direct consequence, but it changes the map, the choices, what's at stake, in a sense. You know, Americans are led to believe by their public intellectuals and by their leadership that this enemy is not just these handful of people, but it's a large section of the globe. Something called Islam, something called Muslims, in a sense, and that it's external. It's external. I mean, there's a complete reluctance to acknowledge that the ways in which Islam is internal to the U.S., a complete reluctance to acknowledge that Islam in the U.S. is not simply the guys who came off the plane from South Asia and West Africa and Middle East over the last 10 years, but actually has been as old as the American Republic. 8-9% of the slaves were Muslims. Half the Muslims in the U.S. are African Americans. Who knows that? Right? They all look at Park Slope and listen. They think that the Muslims are the people who came 10 years ago, 5 years ago. They are the rich sheikhs. But they are part of American society. They are Malcolm X. They are Muhammad Ali. These are the Muslims of the U.S. And so this inability to acknowledge that they are dealing with a group which is as internal. It's not just external. I think these questions.
And that's enough of yesterday's Democracy Now!, folks. if you want to see here today's Democracy Now!, just go to www.democracynow.org, and you should get it. If you're able to hear this show at all, since we're only streaming at the moment, that is an option for you. Or you can listen to old Democracy Now!. That might be interesting stuff. I mean, after all, there's no Democracy Now! Anyway, nor is there likely to be democracy tomorrow. So, what difference does it make? You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, once we get back on the air, and freakradio.org. I'm Robert, and coming up next, it's Bathurst Spears Broadsides. You've been listening to the strains of choral and
body comfort.
Body comfort? Buddy comfort. There we go. So tune in again, and perhaps you'll hear more of them, or perhaps just pick up your computer. Stay tuned for 2 hours of Bathurst Spears Broadsides with special call-in interview from Doug Loisel, former executive director of the Homeless Service Center, and Linda Jolly, a Menlo Park activist. And plus, who knows what else we got planned. It's going to be a surprise, perhaps even to me.
What's everyone gonna do?
I'm going downtown, I see a friend, I'm going to lose it. Cousin man, yeah, wang, gang, do that, she whiskey, little.
Yeah,
bring
it. I got them blue eyed devil's blues. I got them blue eyed devil's blues. Yeah. Sitting around and playing for you, I was wishing I was thinking that I'd do. Yeah, Lord, I got them blue eyed devil's blues.
Them blue-eyed devil blues from Hard Luck Town. That's a 10-year-old CD that's got a kind of a honky-tonk quality to it. You're tuned to the stream of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We are at freakradio.org, and one of these days, probably on Sunday, maybe next Thursday for sure, I would hope, we will be back streaming away, I should say, floating away, or broadcasting away. Beaming away? I don't know what proper word is, but we'll be on the air, hopefully, on 101.1 FM, where we have traditionally been, at least pretty much for the last decade. And you'll be able to catch us while you're, you know, avoiding the drive-bys and the speeding tickets and everything else, or just trying to survive in your vehicle while the police attempt to give you tickets. So in any case, that should be coming up soon. You should be able to catch this on the radio soon. In the meantime, you can call in and talk to me here on the air if you're listening on the stream. And I am live if you are listening on September 15th, Thursday evening, because that's what it is right now, or at least that's my time at the moment. The new Street Spirit is out. That's the September 2011 version. And in this issue of Street Spirit, Linda LeMaster has her first published story in, I think it's at least 4 years. Street Spirit has not been particularly kind to Santa Cruz in the last 4 or 5 years in terms of publishing stuff. But times may be changing. This is Linda's story, Busted in Jail for Sleep Crimes at Peace Camp. And I've been following this, and so those of you who are regular listeners may be getting a little bored of the whole thing. But this is really a continuing struggle to stand up for the rights of poor people by some of us who are, well, mostly who are mostly poor, and some who are indoors and some who are outdoors. But Linda LeMaster has been a long-time struggler on this issue. Her health is fragile in the extreme, but she is still refusing to take deals that DA Bob Lee is proposing. She is refusing to plead to this and plead to that, although HUF, Homeless United, or Houseless United, as some would like to say, for Friendship and Freedom, has agreed to support her in whatever she decides to do. She was one of the many, the dozens of people who supported Peace Camp 2010, the attempt to raise consciousness and supply a safe sleeping space last year for many homeless people. And already two Peace Camp 2010 activists are serving, or have served at least a couple weeks in jail, and are slated to serve another 5.5 months in jail. That's Attorney Ed Fry and Gary Johnson. They're appealing their case. I think they just got a transcript of their trial, which they're passing on to Attorney Jonathan Gettleman, who is Linda LeMaster's pro bono attorney. I published a little description of what was going on indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. That's Santa Cruz Indie Media. The trouble is sometimes indie media does not keep up with me, or I don't post stuff soon enough. And if you go to the calendar section, which is a section at the top of the Santa Cruz Indie Media website, and you go back to, and you actually go further, you click on the word calendar, which is at the top, you will see a story, D.A. Bob Lee Tries Linda LeMaster for Sleep Ban Protest. And that was actually a hearing scheduled for 9 o'clock on Wednesday morning, which I guess ended up happening about 11:45. Thank you very much, Judge Gallagher, for your help in doing that. Or I guess we could blame Jonathan Gettleman for not trying to call the case sooner. But rather than apportion blame, the point actually was that there's kind of a victory in that case. Linda is accused of illegal lodging, violating Penal Code 647E, which is actually the city and county's way of going after political protesters who are outside overnight with political signs. If you fall asleep, they say, oh, you're lodging, so you're guilty of a crime punishable by up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine. This case is outrageous, particularly if you have a political sign in front of you and you are advancing a political cause, and particularly outrageous in this particular neck of the woods when the city of Santa Cruz has place for less than 5% of the homeless people in shelter and criminalizes all the rest after 11 o'clock at night by its municipal code statutes as well as by 647E, which they pull out when they want to really kick people around hard. Yeah. So I summarized the little bit of the history. I always, being a vast history buff myself, I wrote about this come to the trial readiness hearing for Linda LeMaster on Wednesday. Homeless researcher and activist. She was cited last August for sleeping out at a political protest in front of the courthouse. Peace Camp 2010 was a protest, I'm reading from it, it's easier that way for me, against the city's sleeping ban, which forced the city to make a significant changes in the law. And then there's all kinds of interesting references if you want to go back and actually study the history of this. I'm hoping some people will. That's why I put all these references in. Two protesters I've already mentioned before have already been sentenced to 6 months in jail and served several weeks. Currently out on appeal, but due to be caged again if the appeal is denied as anticipated. Linda LeMaster's own viewpoint is set down in the latest issue of Street Spirit, which is online, by the way, at www.thestreetspirit.org. Check it out. And you can find Linda's story there. Recent correspondence and court motions in the related Fry and Johnson cases can be found at fullspectrumdemocracy.org. Anyway, the outcome of this And you can read the description of further about the actual history of the case and where to go to get, you know, the nitty-gritty of the history or even the frills and thrills of the history. The outcome was that Jonathan Gettleman was presenting a writ of habeas corpus motion, which is, to my eyes, a peculiar motion to present in a court when the person is not in jail. Usually you write from jail, you get an attorney to go before a judge and say, my client's in jail, I want a writ to get this guy out, a writ of habeas corpus. It means bring me the body, and they have to bring the body of the prisoner to the court, and then the person has to be charged with something. Can't just hold them like they do in, you know, anti-American places like Guantanamo and Santa Cruz County Jail on occasion for all kinds of things. That doesn't happen here, as we know. In any case, the writ is supposed to protect people and require that they be charged before they are held for any length of time. In this case, however, Jonathan Gettleman is using the writ of habeas corpus for a different purpose. And I actually, he was nice enough to send me a copy of his pleading, his writ, which I actually have here somewhere, if I can find the darn thing. Let's see if it's around here. It says an error has occurred on this page. Well, let me see if I can find it anyway. Let's see here. That ain't it. May be kind of hard for me to locate. But I'm going to try to post Jonathan's writ, maybe even if I can find someone to scan them in a few of the exhibits. Jonathan is claiming that you cannot go after political protesters with the 647E lodging law because you are misusing the law. So Linda shouldn't even reach trial. There's no real charge against her because what they're trying to do is punish her for political speech by using another law, which does not really apply. She wasn't there to lodge. She had no intention to set up a campsite and, you know, dig in and start roasting weenies and, you know, set up a shop for the next week and a half. No, she was there to support one of her fellow protesters, Christopher Doyen, who was ill, and also to maintain the vigil through the night around the issue of dropping the laws that criminalize homeless people who have no legal place to sleep. And it's a pretty simple statement, but to show you how twisted and obscured and alienated from the truth our community has become, the police and the courts have been able to use this bogus pretext of lodging to shut down that political protest and discourage others from doing the same sense. Although one of our Huff folks, Casey Livingood, did, in solidarity with Food Not Bombs and their Thou Shalt Be Able to Feed Poor People protest in Orlando, Florida, he slept out in front of the city hall, and for his audacity, he had the audacity of hope, I guess, he was given a camping ticket. So he was again punished. He, in other words, was not deterred. And I wasn't either. I actually slept out the night before with him. I was in my car, actually, but I was still vulnerable to the powers that be, as those of us who were in solidarity did and will be. And unfortunately, that's just what you got to do. You want to challenge this kind of stuff, preferably with 10,000 people behind you in Tahrir Square or one of the other places, as we see it happening in foreign countries. And then things really change. You know, just get a headline or two in the paper, or even some passionate support on blogs. So, what Jonathan Gettleman seems to be trying to do is to stop this whole prosecution before it starts. And there's going to be a month's delay before this motion is heard because the district attorney never heard of such a thing. He's going to have to scratch his head or her head. I'm not sure if it's, I think it's a woman who's actually, you know, carrying the crap for DA Bob Lee, who's continuing this nonsensical prosecution at a significant cost to the county and everybody else, again, with the idea of repressing this kind of behavior by political protesters. We see BART police doing it up in San Francisco, where they arrest political protesters without cause, actually without charge, for being in the BART station with a banner. They don't even say they're blocking anything. They just arrest them and haul them away. And, of course, you know, hopefully down the line they'll be sued and they'll get their asses kicked. But in the meantime, people have to wonder, am I going to stand up and speak out against the murder of Charles Hill or Oscar Grant by BART police? Or am I going to face this kind of curbside justice, curbside punishment, curbside repression? And, of course, that's what they want you to be afraid of, and that's what they want you to do, whether it's Santa Cruz or San Francisco. But don't be afraid, or if you're afraid, say, hey, there are other things to be more afraid of, like losing your soul or letting yourself be humiliated and shamed and intimidated every time a guy with a badge and a gun and a little radio squawk box walks by. It's going to be a struggle because these people are intimidating. They simply are because that's what they're trained to do. That's what they're paid to do. That's what they like to do. And that's what they do, whether it's Santa Cruz, San Francisco, or Egypt, or Libya, or whatever. So, at 6:30, I am going to be getting a call, I believe, from Linda Jolly, who may or may not be in a jolly mood. She's a Menlo Park activist I've had on the air before, I believe, and she lives in her vehicle, and she speaks out quite strongly for the rights of homeless people over the hill. Menlo Park is a community of, I don't know how many, I think it's more than 100,000, but maybe we'll find more out more about Menlo Park when I get Linda on the line. Maybe we can do a little kind of scouring around here and see what I can find. She may even be mentioned. I find when I Google for myself, I sometimes find interesting things, sometimes rather wild and crazy charges. But let's see if we can find anything for Linda online under her name. She goes to city council meetings in Palo Alto. There's not too much that's clear here. Let's look up the Menlo Park homeless and see what we can find. Menlo Park is kind of a, as I remember, it's kind of a conservative community. Menlo Park shelters, Michelle Obama build something for the Menlo Park homeless. A 70-bed homeless shelter will open in April, but it's going to close, sorry. Not open in April, close in April. Because I assume it's because of funding difficulties, but it's really, I have an ambivalent attitude towards shelters. They're such wretched places, generally, and they're such token places. It's generally no fun. Let's see if I can find something more specific. What I should do perhaps is read a little bit of what she wrote me. I mean, now she's going to be talking more about things. She read the story I sent out about activist Linda LeMaster facing what we thought was going to be a jury trial next week, and this trial readiness hearing yesterday turned out that, again, that's postponed for a month and perhaps more. When they'll hear this writ of habeas corpus motion that the whole case sucks and shouldn't even go to trial. But she wrote back, I read your summary of the recent, and you are great. One comment, when they are homeless and lost everything, why not just give them the worst hell and go to jail? I mean, food, safety. Recently, the goddamn system here was trying to take away my work truck. I had a pound and a half of paperwork trying to solve it peacefully. Did not work. They are too stupid, immoral. I marched into the city manager's office, left the paperwork, said I would be arrested there if not fixed, go to jail, and spend my time there writing the media. They fixed it. And I then invited her on the air to talk about the details of her struggle. And she wrote me back, I spent the better part of a year writing letters similar to the attached. I don't know if I can download the attached on this computer, but maybe I can. Robert, trying to save my work truck from the predator state. In this case, I finally won because I promised to put my body in their office and call the media during my arrest. I suspect that a lot of folks have not won because they were not willing to do that. And as a result, they are sleeping in the bushes, trying to hide from the predator, and losing their health. Government has descended in general to a really shameful state. I am 68, and I have seen their sleaze time after time, and have a written list of what they have done, if I can get it out of a frozen disk. I think it is time for the oppressed poor folks to get really rough, and will say so on the air. Looking forward, Linda Jolly. And that's a kind of a preview of Linda. I think actually I may have some earlier correspondence with her, which I will look for here. But before I, while we're kind of waiting for Linda to call, I'm going to kind of give you a few updates. I played a lot of stuff from Watsonville on Sunday. Watsonville is a city to the south of Santa Cruz. I think it's got about 30 to 40,000 people. I think it's almost as big as Santa Cruz now. Large population, a Latino population, and the mayor and the police chief will actually talk to homeless activists, though they haven't talked to me. I haven't tried to talk to them. But that's what we heard from Jen Laskin, who invited me down to this seminar on youth and power, where I did a lot of interviews and played them, as I mentioned last show. The Watsonville City Council met on Tuesday night, and I believe there were some Brown Berets there. Brown Berets were the people who were supporting and sponsoring the conference on Saturday that I went to. I wasn't actually able to find any members of the homeless Levy community who've been driven away by the police from the river, just as our homeless community in Santa Cruz is regularly harassed along the riverside. I do get regular reports in Santa Cruz from activist David Silva, who I believe has lost his phone. He couldn't afford to continue to pay for it. He's still seeking donations, and an anonymous person has agreed to match any donation to David Silva's, I would call it, survival fund. And, you know, there are a lot of people out there trying to survive. Why support David Silva specifically? Well, because Silva is not just surviving, he's also acting as a correspondent who's trying to let us know what's going on out there, whether it's on the levee with the police or at the homeless service center, with people being excluded from the Paul Lee Loft, or people being badly treated at different medical facilities, if that happens. Or going, he went to city council on Tuesday, the same day when the Watsonville City Council had their meeting, and spoke to that city council, our city council. But getting back, and so I encourage people to get in touch with me at 423-4833. If you want to donate something to David Silva's survival campaign, then this, apparently this guy's going to match the donations, anything that comes in. So you can double your fund or double David Silva's survival chances by kicking down some money. There was a story in the, actually an op-ed piece in the Watsonville Pajaronian, which is the Watsonville newspaper, sometimes a more interesting paper than the Santa Cruz Urinal, or Sentinel as I call it. What Jen Laskin wrote was, "We need better solutions for our homeless." And she wrote, "I am writing to express my concerns over the police-led evacuation of the homeless community on the levee that was destroyed last week. We, a local coalition, have been working with homeless folks at the levee since January 2011, when we participated in the homeless census. It was discovered that more than 200 people were living at the levee. More than 350, many more in reality, live in Watsonville, spread out among the few shelters in the streets. These people have nowhere to go. They are workers. They have lost their previous homes and jobs. One of our lead mechanics at the bike shack did a school report as a high school senior at AVCI, and discovered that one woman is living there because she spent all her money bringing her deceased son to Mexico to bury him. Upon her return, she needed to get her savings back together, so she was living at the levee. Other communities have city-sanctioned tent cities or areas where the people in this situation can go to live." Of course, not Santa Cruz. "Fresno is a good example. Again, many of these people are workers. They live there because there is no affordable housing. To their credit, the police are currently working," that's the Watsonville police, "with the city staff and select resource agencies that serve this homeless population to figure out longer-term solutions as opposed to simple destruction and disposal of property. However, this is not a sustainable plan." Jen, I got to say, by the way, I'm going to interrupt her op-ed piece. She is rather optimistic about her police department, as she is about the American Civil Liberties Union, on whose board she sits, and who will be having their next meeting next Monday, 7 o'clock at Loudoun Nelson Center, for those who want to check out that kind of foolishness. However, she is writing publicly. I'm glad she is. She met with the police chief last week, and the fact that people are trying to hold these officials accountable, provided they understand at some level how futile that is and how much it is a form of posturing, is not a bad thing. Not the posturing, not the futility, but shining the light of publicity on these folks. What do you suggest, Jen continues, we, the concerned voters and community members, do to support a beneficial solution to this problem? I personally am horrified that the Watsonville PD threw away so many personal belongings of people, which, by the way, is the official policy of the Santa Cruz Parks and Rec Department. They destroy property. They do not save it. In direct violation to state law, not to mention the federal constitution and federal court decisions and the successful lawsuits in Fresno, which I've talked about endlessly on this show. That the homeless in Watsonville were warned of the eviction with 24 hours notice, with no access to services or references of where to go, no assistance to help gather, pack, and move their things. I also read and witnessed many bikes being trashed. Are these bikes going to be thrown away? Many of these people are clients of the bike shack. We at least could have saved the bikes for the folks and stored them. All their other things were being thrown into a dumpster. It is also just plain wrong that the residents of a wonderful community program, the Si Se Puede Recovery Center, were used as free labor to do the dirty work of the police, somewhat similar to where in Santa Cruz labor-ready crews are used to destroy homeless property in the Poconep and elsewhere. Some of these residents do not know the task beforehand, or did not know it, and felt badly about the work they were asked to do. Yet they were told it was, quote, community service. The city has land. It is vacant. Is there a solution or a plan that the city council and the Watsonville PD have for these people? There are agencies and organizations that serve the community, such as the Community Action Board, the Salvation Army, Victory Outreach, Loaves and Fishes, and local churches. The Homeless Garden Project in Santa Cruz is also a good example of a program that serves, feeds, and provides homeless people with practical skills. It actually doesn't serve and feed homeless people at all. It ruthlessly employs a small number of homeless people to provide a show program that provides food to middle-class people. But it does give 20 homeless people, I guess, as minimum wage, something like that. Certainly not a living wage, and no place to live, as far as I know. Ah, there's my call. I'm going to have to finish this letter, and I will try to do that before the end of the show. This is Jen Laskin we've been listening to, but we do have our caller calling in. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert.
Is this the evil Linda Jolly?
Yes, the evil, more evil than ever.
Well,
the government tried to kill me, but I live on, and I'm getting more and more nasty.
Well, I actually read your nasty missive to me on the Hotmail that you sent me about your struggle with the challenge to the city manager to shape up and give you your vehicle back or face the wrath of Linda.
Right, right. And if we could have me cloned, we'd have a decent government in no time, because I fight back. A lot of people don't fight back, and that's the problem. But you are doing a great job over there. You're conducting the most important campaign in this country, which is to fight back against the predator state.
Well, it's nice of you to say so. I would say that there are plenty of places that have gotten better track records than we do here, but, you know, we do what we can, and I'm going to begin. You're a Menlo Park resident. Is that where you live?
Yes, Menlo Park. But be careful when you say resident. I resent the fact that the government is trying to force everybody to be a resident of some place. They don't want to face the fact that many people live on wheels, and many people move around a lot, and they get nasty if you don't have a residential address. And I resent that.
Well, we want to keep you in your box, you know.
Yeah. Well, I resent a lot of things that they're doing. They have trashed the Bill of Rights. They have tried to exterminate low-income people, no matter how decent those people have been. They're trying to run the poor people out of town. They're trying to make poor people lose their vehicles, which I almost did. It's a mess, and we need people to go into the courthouse and poop there. Let them know that this is supposed to be a democracy and we're not going to take it anymore.
So, you know, again, give us a little bit of the thumbnail story of how they went after your vehicle and how you responded.
Well, it started with the new smog law that they passed a couple of years ago This does not have to do with protecting clean air, really. It has to do with the government trying to collect money. A nasty lady named Lori Saldana, she was in the California Assembly, and she pushed through a new law eliminating free smog extensions. Well, you know how long it can take to get a vehicle smogged sometimes. All the details, all the mechanical, it can take 4 visits to a mechanic and 5 visits to a smog center, all that.
Right.
This is a horrible thing that she did to low-income people because we just don't have time and money for the hassle.
So what was the change that she instituted?
She pushed through the assembly a new smog law now called Vehicle Code 4156, saying that you cannot have time to get your smog, your car smogged if it's not smogged immediately at the time of registration. Then you have to start paying penalties immediately. When I went to the DMV, I didn't know about this. They had not bothered to inform me in the registration literature. They caught me by the surprise and demanded $50 on the spot. It's like $50 a month if you're not smart.
Uh-huh. And you live in your vehicle, right?
Well, if I admit to that, I'd be admitting to being a criminal.
There are some who suspect you are a vehicle criminal by habitating a vehicle, Linda.
I guess you have other people trying to get on the line.
No, I don't think so.
Well, I hear a beeping. Maybe it's somebody trying to get on, reach me. Anyway, I did not have the extra $50. I mean, it took every nickel I could muster just to get in there and get through the smog test, pay the mechanic for the smog test. And then I flaunted not bombarding me with citations. Immediately, I mean, almost as soon as I got out of the DMV office, I started getting citations on my truck. And then I found out that you can no longer fight citations. They just want you to pay them. They want the money. And I got citations from three different jurisdictions, total of 4, and later on it turned into 6. I mean, they were like yellow jackets on me saying, you pay us money now or we're going to take your vehicle. You know, you can get towed after 5 citations. Did you know that?
And it's 3 in Santa Cruz.
Oh, boy. And you know what? They don't have to give you a trial. One of these citations, I almost never got a trial or a hearing.
Well, you know, in Santa Cruz, it's tow first, trial later.
That kind of thing.
If you can find the appropriate, if the commissioner will give you a trial, you can't get into the criminal courts anymore with these citations. In fact, my housemate, or I should say my former housemate, was in a lengthy struggle to secure his vehicle here. He's a very dogged and determined individual, and it's... I've been trying to give homeless people advice on what to do if the police come and threaten to confiscate your vehicle. And I know your suggestion was, you know, march to City Hall and say, good, arrest me or deal with this issue. It sounds like that's what you suggested in your email.
I wound up taking a firm stand that I presented to all the local city governments that were citing me. I mean, we have a whole bunch of cities close together here, and I was cited by several cities. And I wrote them letters saying, here's my position. Truck is my means of earning a living. I cannot replace it. If you take away my truck, I will become a criminal. And I will live in your jails, and I will write to media all over the country telling them what the predatory state has done to me. And I think they finally grasped the concept when I... offered to present my body in their offices and be arrested and thrown in the media while I was being arrested.
Now, what office did you present yourself at?
I've been to so many offices, you can't count them, but the final Most of my citations were dismissed after I wrote these nasty letters, but I wound up, I could not get a dismissal in Menlo Park. I couldn't even get a trial or a hearing. And so I went to the city manager's office. By then I had accumulated a pound and a half of paperwork on this nonsense. It had taken most of my time for a year. I went to the city manager's office and presented the paperwork with a demand letter saying that you have to take care of this or I'm going to do a sit-in in your office. I have the media phone numbers in my phone, and I will be arrested and live in your jails.
Now, let me ask you, did you actually have any sympathizers in the media, or was this an idle threat?
It was not an idle threat. I have had a conversation with Bonnie Esslinger of the local Daily News here. She's a very good reporter. But you know how the media works, right? You were a journalist, right? They want just top-level stories. I mean, there's got to be a phonograph of somebody being handcuffed, something of that sort, a lot of human interest and everything. So you have to really make some news, like maybe a poop-in would be good.
You mean a shit-in? Is that what you're suggesting?
You guys did, and, well, you guys were very aggressive in Santa Cruz, and I think that's great. The government is in such a bad, lazy state of mind that they are not going to fix these things unless people get physical.
Well, I'm still a little unsure. How did this get fixed, and who fixed it?
Well, after presenting all this stuff to the city manager stood there for 20 minutes telling me it was not his problem. That's how bureaucrats always behave. And I said to him, city managers run cities. It is your problem. And there will be a sit-in unless you fix it soon. And so I finally made him accept the responsibility. And
what did he do to fix it?
He passed the case on to the police. I thought that was kind of weird, you know, trial by police. But he passed it to a police commander who had some intelligence. And after a while, the commander decided to have my citations dismissed. This is a strange way to get due process, isn't it?
I thought these were civil civil citations you didn't have a right to appear in court on, and yet he could dismiss them as a police officer?
Yes. Well, they're trying to take away the traditional court system. I figured that out quite a while ago.
In Santa Cruz, what we have is, I mean, I think the parking authority is independent of the police department. I'm pretty sure they're the different authorities. So maybe in Menlo Park it's different. I mean, once you get caught up in the bureaucracy of the parking authority, good luck. I mean, the police department has its own problems too, no question.
Yeah.
But so we're talking. Go ahead.
This police commander told me that in certain cases the police there have the authority to dismiss citations. But I thought this was weird. I mean, you always were supposed to see a judge in the past, and these kind of things were considered fix-it tickets.
When did all this happen, by the way? When were you?
It started a little over a year ago, continued for a whole year while I wrote letters and did everything I could to fix it peacefully, and then it culminated this last June when I walked into the city manager's office and I said, this is it. By then I was getting new citations for not having my new registration for this year because I couldn't pay the old citations which had been attached to my registration. You know, they make it so it just gets worse and worse until you surrender and kill yourself.
I gotta confess, Linda, I'm jammed up for time, so I'm gonna give you a couple minutes to conclude this, and also, I guess, do you have any sympathizers in the homeless community or in the vehicularly housed community? I know that's a crime.
Yeah, we have thousands of people living in vehicles right here in the peninsula area, area of Menlo Park, Redwood City, thousands of them, and some of them do get cited and they can't pay the $200 fine and wind up losing their vehicles. But we don't have the riots that we need to fix this.
Well put.
You know. Hello?
I'm right here.
Yeah.
So do you actually, I mean, do you actually meet with any of these other vehicle people? Do they actually, I mean, have you, has anybody else adopted your strategy? Have you had any kind of group sessions of any kind?
We don't have any organized groups meeting. I wish that we did, but I can't make a living while I'm working as an activist, you know? And we need a lot of activism here. But the people, the homeless people are somewhat pacified by all the free meals that exist around here. And they're timid, and they have not, it's not possible to get them to do a good fight back right now. It's different than your situation in Santa Cruz.
Well, maybe not that much different. But I know I think you've been on the air with me before, you know, and
yeah.
We've talked about, you had the same problem before. I mean, there are, there are ways, and I think Stanford has a bunch of students who claim to be interested in homeless issues, and there's a major...
Yeah. We have a hot issue going on over here. The city of Palo Alto has tried to pass an ordinance against sleeping in cars, and a bunch of people got together and fought them.
I know. We've actually had that on the air a couple weeks ago, and
yeah.
I'm curious how that's going. My problem, though, is I don't have time to talk about it now. Maybe we can get you back on the air on Sunday if you're going to be around.
Well, I know you got a lot of people waiting, and I'll let you go. But I just want to say, from my point of view, the worst aspect of this poverty thing is the way the government is treating people, and we need people to get aggressive to fight back against the GD government. Go in their offices and sit there and demand action.
Hear, hear. Do you have a website where people can, where we can send the FBI to keep an eye on you?
I don't have a website, but my phone number is 650-630-3021. And anybody is welcome to call me.
At 650-630-3021. That was too fast for folks listening. Just call 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and I will give you Linda's number. Linda, thank you for letting us know that at least one vehicle is back in the rightful hands of its owner, it sounds like to me.
And I would like people to try to make sure that Lori Saldana does not make it into the Senate. She's going to try to run for the Senate, and it's horrible to have people like that in government. They pass these laws that stomp the life out of poor people, and we need to get those people out of government.
Rory is the one who put the anti-smog, no further delays, you pay or we tow.
Right. This is a horrible thing to do to poor people. Try to make sure Lori Saldana does not get in government, in the Senate. Put her head on a stake.
Hey, hey.
Yeah.
Well, in the meantime, keep up the fight and give me a call back on Sunday if you'd like, 9:30 to 1 sometime in the morning.
If I can, I will.
All right. I'll be waiting for you along with, we'll have a church service here.
A church service?
Yes.
I thought you were not religious.
I'm making a joke, actually. It's the religion of the streets, so to speak.
The religion of the streets. Okay.
All right.
All right. Thanks a lot, Robert. God bless you.
Hey, good luck to you, babe.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And that was Linda Jolly over in Menlo Park describing rather in compressed time how she got her vehicle back. Let's take a brief musical break, and we'll be preparing now for Doug Loisel's interview. He's coming up around at 7.
I won't be your dog woman, or even be your friend. I won't be your dog woman, even be your friend. Keep doing the things you do. Again and again. You stayed out last night, woman, while I go to sleep. You stayed out last night, woman, while I go to sleep.
And that was another quickie from the hard luck town called Won't Be Your Dog. Okay, now this is a long-promised audio section of a video, which is kind of self-explanatory, so I'm just going to go directly into it since I'm expecting a call shortly from, again, former Homeless Service Center Executive Director Doug Loisel. So this is an interview that involves questions that were fired at the current Homeless Service Center Director Monica Martinez around the issue of protecting homeless people from the police against the kind of harassment for sleeping tickets that police regularly, I should say, that homeless people regularly face.
So here is a clip about 40 minutes into the Homelessness in Santa Cruz video, which is a video you can find on Voices from the Village, and it was a panel discussion on the community TV show hosted by Louis LaFortune, including Steve Plaich, Monica Martinez, Peter Connery, and Father Joel Miller. Steve's a homelessness advocate, or a homeless person's advocate. Monica is the head of the Homeless Service Center. Peter is an individual involved with the homeless census, and Father Joel Miller provides a meal to the homeless once a week at the Calvary Episcopal Church and has been under some pressure from right-wing city council members and community members for doing so. The whole thing is kind of interesting. The discussion itself is kind of fluffy and, to me, rather substanceless. But at one point, Louis LaFortune, actually at my earlier urging, raised the issue of the sleeping ban, the law that criminalizes homeless people at night after 11 o'clock in Santa Cruz, and raised it for Monica Martinez, who's the Homeless Service Center executive director, who controls the policies there, subject to approval or disapproval by the board of directors. And there have been issues we've been trying to raise for a year, basically around the fact that the Homeless Service Center is perpetually filled, at least the shelter programs are filled as a waiting list. And so if the Homeless Service Center would only make clear that this is the case, it would tend to theoretically put a breaker on the police from issuing camping tickets or threatening to issue them when people have no other option but to camp. In particular, it would also have a lot of impact on the prosecutions of homeless people for peacefully protesting this last year and perhaps any future protests, because the city is falsely claiming that there is space for people they aren't really clear where, but they're trying to use it to stop the protest defense, the so-called necessity defense that people are using or were trying to use last year when they were arrested for falling asleep at the protest in front of the courthouse and in front of City Hall at so-called Peace Camp 2010. Here is this discussion, and I will comment on it afterward.
I am aware that, you know, we do have this so-called sleeping ban in Santa Cruz.
This is Louis LaFortune, who is the moderator.
The city of Santa Cruz, the council refers to it as a camping ban, I believe. But the law, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the law says that it's illegal to cover yourself with a blanket during certain hours. And thus preventing sleep. So that's why it's commonly referred to as the sleeping ban.
Actually, it actually prohibits falling asleep or covering up with blankets between 11 and 8:30 in the morning.
So tickets are issued for this. And I'm going to refer to... So this is one of the many problems that homeless people have, is that they're being penalized for being poor, basically. It's the criminalization of poverty. And so they have this cost. Right? They're breaking the law. By going to sleep, they're breaking the law. But, so they have this cost that they have to absorb.
Right.
And, of course, if they had any money at all, you know, they wouldn't be homeless. So it's just adding, to me, it sounds like it's just adding insult to injury. Or more injury to injury is maybe a better way to say it. The city is citing these people. Now, because we know, we've established, I think, here that there's a severe lack of space. Why are they continuing to cite people, do you think, and how can we solve this problem of people getting cited and then having to go and appear in court and say, well, look, I can show you that at the shelter, at your shelter or at some other shelter, there was no space. And so I have no choice. I have to be out here. How do we deal with that? Is there a way to provide these people with a document that says to the officer, right, the officer's giving them about to write them a ticket, look, officer, I have proof that there's no space. Is that something we can do?
Well, you know, one of the things that, you know, that comes out of the surveys...
This is Peter Cooper, who is the sort of front man on the census survey, which was this actual topic of this video, of this hour-long program. And I actually thought of shortening this whole thing because it's a little attenuated, but it does eventually get down to the nitty-gritty. Peter Cooper.
What we do in all of our census and survey work is that the homeless population have a lot of issues that they have to deal with. 63% of the population in Santa Cruz County have a disabling condition that gets in the way of housing or full-time employment. So some of those disabling conditions are substance abuse, but they're also mental illness, severe depression, physical disabilities, etc., that make it very challenging for them to go with more rational efforts to find housing and get full-time employment that just isn't available to them and they can't sustain. They've got issues about, you know, their clothing, showering, etc., that make it difficult to hold down a full-time job, even though 24% of the homeless population work full or part-time.
And again, all this stuff is not really responsive to what the moderator is asking, which is, homeless people have a lot of problems. Why add this additional problem of getting tickets and then having the homeless service center? And this is what you're going to find happening. And this is my concern, not assisting the homeless in revealing the true situation, that they have no place to go and therefore they cannot be constitutionally or legally ticketed for falling asleep where they must.
It's that expensive to live in this county. So there's a lot of things that are barriers to finding housing that need to be addressed. So there is a mechanism in the city whereby if you go to the homeless service...
This is Steve Plaich, who's a Homelessness Legal Assistance Project, but unfortunately he's also a community politician running for political office who apparently doesn't want to offend his guest, Monica Martinez, or I should say they're both guests on Louis LaFortune's show. They're sitting right next to each other or close to each other, and, you be the judge.
So you set up on their waiting list, and if you receive a ticket while your name is on the waiting list, there is a process by which the paralegal from the city attorney's office will call over to Homeless Services Center, and they will compare numbers and names on the list, and if your name appears on the list, that ticket will be automatically dismissed. That doesn't relieve the problem of how difficult it is to get on the list, whether or not people have the energy or the wherewithal to get over and get themselves on the list, that kind of thing. Would it be better if they had some kind of a receipt that they could show a police officer? They're still going to get arrested, but if they had some kind of receipt that said, yes, I'm on the waiting list, please either find me a place to stay or let me sleep, I think that might work. But you really have, that's also in the command structure of the police department. You have to convince them that, in my opinion, I campaigned the city council last year on the complete repeal of the camping ban. And I think that the camping ban is a failed policy. It's a policy that's been held by this city council for a long period of time. So until you completely repeal the camping ban, you're still going to have some level of problems. What we're trying to do, what Monica tried to, what I'm trying to do, maybe, is to ease the burden of the camping ban on people, which is the best you can do. Ease the burden. However that is done, I'll do it by trying to provide some legal services or suggesting a receipt process or calling the city attorney's office saying, are we comparing these names? Are they really dismissing tickets? But we do what we can, you know, until there is a complete repeal of the camping ban, and what you need for that is political will. And it's hard for one person to generate that kind of political will, although I don't intend to stop trying. The other thing, Louis, is that it's pretty clear from the numbers that the camping ban's not working on reducing the number of homeless in Santa Cruz County.
Absolutely, from a results perspective,
it's a failed policy, and it's consistent with other similar efforts, the broken windows discussions out there, where there's a lot of, you know, citations to homeless and those at the lower end of the poverty level as a deterrent to crime. The criminologists have proven that doesn't work.
I completely agree.
Yeah, so what we're talking about here is this idea of just harm reduction, right? We're harming these people.
Absolutely. But you're trying to reduce the harm. You're trying to reduce the burden until such time as the city council, the people who are really the policymakers, decide that this really isn't deterring homelessness. It really isn't helping anything at all in terms of the policy it's supposed to be supporting. So why don't we do away with it? Let's try something different. You know, let's try a different way.
So we have a question from... Wow, a studio audience.
And this is where actually I stood up. I was the only person in the studio audience and asked what I think was the point. The panelists are all talking around the issue, as far as I'm concerned, although it isn't really clearly been presented as such. The issue isn't, yeah, the city council should wise up, the camping ban sucks, all these things are certainly true. But the real policymakers that are relevant are the people who are on that forum platform right there, right now. And one of them is the Homeless Service Center head, Monica Martinez, who has specifically the power to make it really clear that the Homeless Service Center is full, and to issue letters to that effect to the courts, and to issue letters to that effect to the police that say this person is on a waiting list, and under the new law, if you're on a waiting list, tickets will be dismissed, so don't write a ticket in the first place. For a year, she's refused to do this. And we also see that people like Steve Plaich, who's on the panel, refuse to confront her on this issue because he doesn't want to embarrass her in front of the community, whereas my strategy is different. As you'll hear in a moment, I believe embarrassing her is the only way to get this issue dealt with that I can see, given the kind of pussyfooting around that's been going on for a year around this issue, and actually for several decades around the issue of this immiseration of homeless people through laws like the sleeping ban and the camping ban.
Would you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. My name is Robert Norris, and I work with a group called Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. Throwing the ball back to the police department and the city council seems to me to be a failed policy, if you're going to talk about failed policies. Mm-hmm. And you have here Monica Martinez. Monica is the executive director of the Homeless Service Center. A year ago, homeless people asked her, homeless activists pleaded with her to issue those receipts because that law is a year old that says if you're on a waiting list, tickets will be dismissed. So this could be shown to a police officer that they could still choose to start harassing the person, but it would serve as a deterrent. Monica, you steadfastly refused to do this, and your board has refused to do this. You've also discontinued the policy that allowed those who got camping tickets to walk into the Homeless Service Center and get evidence that on that night the Homeless Service Center was full, a letter from the Homeless Service Center, usually a form letter, because as you know, the Homeless Service Center is full throughout the summer. You have a 2 to 6 week waiting list, as I understand. If that was the case last year, if I'm wrong, I'd like to be corrected on any of this. We tried to get this from you a year ago. You refused to do it. You've refused to do it henceforth. You stopped emailing any kind of responses to us. I would encourage you to change that policy because I think it would help a lot of homeless people. A, restore the letter that says we had no shelter beds that night. So even if we weren't on the waiting list, maybe the person just got into town, they could say, here, Judge Commissioner Baskett, I wasn't on the waiting list, but there was no shelter that night. That has traditionally been done for the last decade by the Homeless Service Center. And then secondly, to do what Steve has suggested and Louis has suggested, which is to issue a letter indicating that they're on the list at a certain date. And I know they have to come back and they have to, you know, renew that and so forth. But I still think it would serve as a deterrent regardless of any discussions you have with the police department. Though I agree with Steve, it would be a good idea to have those kind of discussions. But we had this discussion in August of last year, and I heard from your board, oh, we're going to look right into this. And then, of course, nothing has happened for the last year on this issue. Okay. Perhaps you have something. And you can give me some answers to those questions. Thank you.
So what about that?
Well, did you catch a question? What was the question in there in particular?
Well, will you reissue letters that indicate that the shelter is full on any particular night, regardless of whether people are on the waiting list for the court's approval? And also, will you issue a letter or receipt or form that says you've signed up on the waiting list?
So, as you can imagine, I've been in lengthy discussions with Robert. As you can see from based on his questions, they're certainly not short. There's no short dialogue with Robert Norris. However, you know, we do respond to any request from homeless individuals who are facing the situation that Robert is expressing. If if an individual came in and said a letter would be helpful, we have that letter, and we will provide that. It's not really something that happens in real life very often, but if it did, we would be happy to provide that. We have no policy, as Robert said, that's saying that's something that we do not or will not do. We do not or will not engage in ongoing, never-ending dialogues and conversations, but we do try to meet the needs of the individuals who are accessing services.
Yeah, I guess what he's asking is there a mechanism in place where people can come to you for some kind of document that they can show to the police?
Absolutely. If there's somebody who's being harassed by the police who is... who has received a citation recently, we'll work with them. We'll, if it's a statement on whether or not the shelter is full, we'll provide that. If it's a letter, hey, case manager, can you sign this to say that I signed up, we'll give that, absolutely. It typically isn't something that happens very often, to be honest, but it's certainly something that we do.
All right, well, yeah. Great. That would be part of this harm reduction.
And I also think...
And that's what Monica said on, I guess it was August 14th or thereabouts, a couple weeks into August, at this Community TV Voices from the Village show on the homeless census. Two things wrong, of course, with what she said. One is she claimed that we always do. This has always been our policy, when in fact it's exactly the opposite of what she has said has been her policy. And you might say, well, maybe her workers are doing stuff she doesn't know about. No, I was in the room with her at a homeless community meeting in June, and we specifically asked her these questions, and she and in front of her staff said, we don't do that, and she had nothing else to say about it, indicating that she wasn't objecting to that. She didn't disagree with the fact that they were not issuing letters to people, homeless people in need of evidence for the court, that they were without shelter that night and couldn't get shelter at the homeless service center because the homeless service center was full. Indeed, people have been sentenced to jail because juries have falsely believed that there is shelter in Santa Cruz because of the misrepresentations of the district attorney. And actually, to some extent, the misrepresentations of Monica Martinez. So that's the first thing. The second thing is she's also misstating the fact that there's no receipts issued if you're on the waiting list. You can't have an evidence and show the police officer, I'm on the waiting list. And we actually have a caller here. Hey there, caller. Are you on the line?
Hey, Robert. How are you? It's Doug.
Doug Lozell?
Doug Lozell.
The famous homeless service center director from ages of yore ago.
Excommunicated homeless service center.
Not by me, you're not.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I was waiting for the queue. I felt like maybe this was a good time to call.
Sure. No, I asked you to call in at 7, and it's now 7:10, and you have been listening to this. I just wanted to say the second problem with what Monica said to this to the audience, to the community a month ago, is that, you know, I had hoped, well, even if she's not telling the truth about what the policy has been for the last year, she's publicly stating it is the policy, so now we can... Homeless people can go in, and if they get a ticket, they can get a letter that says the shelter was full. If they go in and get on the waiting list, they can get a letter that says we're on the waiting list. Or the cops, when they see this letter, might decide better use of our resources not to ticket this person because they're on the waiting list, and that ticket automatically gets dismissed. But in sending people over there, we find the staff is doing the same thing as before. They are declining to issue those letters on both counts. Although they do issue a letter that says you are receiving services from the Homeless Service Center, but nothing about a waiting list. So it gives no indication to the police department that a person is in need of shelter, has actually taken the initiative to sign up for shelter, but there ain't no shelter available at this moment because they are on one of these fabulous waiting lists. Now,
right.
If you were in charge, Doug, let me ask you, when you were in charge, what was your policy around this? Of course, there wasn't this law that said, get on a waiting list, avoid a sleeping ban ticket, because that was passed due to pressure from Peace Camp 2010 and homeless protesters, who some of whom are serving time in jail for their service to the community in getting this crazy law somewhat changed.
Right. You know, the waiting list, we I didn't have anything to do with the waiting list. There was no waiting list when I was, well, there was a waiting list when I was there, but it wasn't tied into the sleeping van. And the waiting list is kind of a bad idea anyway, because, you know, if you're, you know, 2 or 3 miles from Homeless Services Center, you're not going to want to walk down, get put on the waiting list, and then walk back up to your campsite. You know, you've either got to take all your stuff with you or it's going to get stolen. I mean, the whole idea of people having to, people forget that, you know, transportation is not easy for homeless persons. And so, you know, getting all the way to over to Homeless Services Center and then getting back to where your belongings are or where you're camping is not necessarily an easy task. So I'm kind of, I mean, the idea is right. I'm not sure about the practicality. You know, as far as people coming in, when I was the executive director there, all people had to do was show up with a citation. And if they had a citation, we gave them a form letter that said, on this night, we were full. And we were full every night. So there was really no issue. So all somebody had to do was bring the citation in. We had a form letter. You write their name in. You write the date in on blank. You know, there were a few blank spaces there, and you know, it was done with, and it was an easy fix. And clearly, I mean, and, you know, there's so little housing for homeless persons or unsheltered persons. I mean, the sleeping van, it's nonsensical to me. So.
Well, I mean, I think actually Monica Martinez might agree with you about the sleeping van, but she's got her head so far up the ass of the police department, if you forgive my graphic reference, that she and her board, including Letitia Schwartz, who you have spoken highly of, and lots of other people who are, you know, these worthy citizens of Santa Cruz, are unwilling to go public on this issue, probably because they're afraid of losing funding, you know, that sort of thing. And I want you to comment on that, but let's first clarify, when were you executive director of the Homeless Service Center? For what period of time?
From March 2009 to October 2009.
And what changes did you initiate there? We can be a bit more broad here, and generally around Homeless Service Center policies.
Well, I mean, one thing we were doing, and I'm not sure if it was going on before we got there or not, we were issuing letters to people who brought in citations. There was a situation, I think, in September of 2009 where it was just tremendously stormy weather. We opened up the whole, there's an overhang that we weren't supposed to do this. We just did it anyway for 3 days, let people sleep underneath the overhang. We put in of plastic so people stayed dry. There was an agreement with, I think, the city council or the police department that we wouldn't do that, and, you know, we did it anyway.
Now, at that time, there were lockers available for storage for homeless people.
Right.
Those
right.
have all been removed, and the last I heard at the last community meeting, they were not putting in, they removed 200 lockers, and they're thinking of putting in 90 back, but they weren't sure because they thought that a community room and a set of offices might be a better use of the space. Your comment?
Well, we were talking about taking out the lockers and moving them to a different area on the campus, but that was because we were also in the process of trying to renovate that area for a recuperative bed program, in which people who were, this is a big problem, and I think I mentioned this maybe in an email to you, you know, one of the big problems we have is people going into the hospital with a broken leg, homeless, coming out of the hospital, after they've had their leg treated, they get a 3-day hotel voucher, and then they're out. And if there's no beds available, then they're basically sleeping outside with a broken leg or an infection or post-surgery or whatever it is their ailment is. We were planning on putting in a recuperative bed program so that they'd have, you know, 30 days or 60 days to recuperate from their whatever procedure they had or whatever their illness was. And so we were going to take out the lockers when I was there, but we were going to go ahead and just relocate them to a different area on the campus. And again, people forget, you know, homeless person, you know, they're carrying all their belongings with them. And so, you know, if they're going to go to a job interview and they don't have a a locker, or if they have to show up to an office somewhere to receive some sort of benefits, et cetera, et cetera. You're carrying all your stuff with you, and that's a problem. You know, again, it's just another obstacle in, you know, matriculating through life.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just wondering, and again, I'm trying to give you kind of, in a certain sense, set up questions here, because it sounds like you're doing the softball thing with that question. I'm saying, do you find it surprising or even outrageous that the lockers have been removed, not been restored, and the authorities are talking about putting in some offices or a community room instead of the lockers?
It's a poor decision. I mean, and it's a decision that I wouldn't have made. I wouldn't necessarily say that I'm outraged. I just think that it leans to the idea that there's not really a level of empathy with the homeless person, and there's really not an identification and an understanding of what a homeless person experiences. That would be my take on it.
Now, in your day, the Pauley Loft had been opened or hadn't been opened?
It was open, yes.
And did you allow people to take bottles of water into the Pauley Loft?
Yeah, I don't think that there was any policy
because
against
people
bottled
have been...
water.
Go ahead.
I don't think there's any policy against bottled water or anything. I mean, I think they basically could bring whatever they wanted up.
According to activist David Silva, a man was expelled recently within the last week from the Homeless Service Center's Pauley Loft for taking a bottle of water with him.
Was it water, or what? I mean, maybe there was alcohol in
it? Not according to him. It was water, it was because it was against the rules, not because it was alcohol. He was expelled for violating the rules.
Well, once again, I wouldn't agree with that, and I wouldn't have made that policy. I mean, if somebody's thirsty, they're thirsty. People got a drink, right?
Oh, you know, you should be grateful for every crumb you get. Wait until morning to get your drink. We need to keep things in order here.
Right, right.
You know, I've praised you for some of the reforms you made. One of the reforms was you opened up the homeless service center bathroom on a 24-hour basis.
Right, right.
Were there any problems you encountered as a result of that?
None. There's no problems. There's some pervasive fear in the community at large around homeless persons, and somehow, we're going to be harmed, or there's going to be some sort of detrimental situation if homeless people are present, or I don't know. I couldn't figure out why nobody had done that before, to be honest with you. And in fact, I was attending the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting at the Calvary Chapel or the Calvary Church. And several homeless persons came up to me after I had made that change and said, hey, we just really want to thank you. Basically, there's no place to go to the bathroom at night in Santa Cruz. Everything is locked up, and basically, you know, we're stuck. And so there were a lot of people who were homeless who were very, really grateful that I had made that policy change.
And I think that policy change, to the credit of the current administration, continues. Did you get any flack from the Harvey West neighbors or any of the local, best boy bigotry groups that are trying to patrol and protect the neighborhood from the unwanted homeless?
Yeah, I got all sorts of flack from the shops across the street, mostly from the persons who were in the immediate area, not necessarily in general area. Although I was trying to move the winter shelter into Harvey West, because at the time, and I'm not sure how it is in Santa Cruz, I don't think things have changed much, there was a whole truckload of warehouse space up in Harvey West. And so I thought, you know, why are we shipping these people all the way over to the Armory when we can have them walk from Homeless Service Center, you know, an eighth of a mile to a warehouse in Harvey West, save money, and have a much better setup. Then they can come back for breakfast, or they can have dinner, then they can go over, they can come back for breakfast. It was really a superior setup, and the person who nixed that was city manager, I think Dick Wilson totally nixed that at a meeting. He just said, it's never going to happen. And I said, well, why not? And he said, well, because Plantronics is up there, and they're the only Fortune 500 company in Santa Cruz, and we're not going to do anything to disturb them.
Didn't Plantronics go under?
I don't know. Maybe they did. I did get some pushback from some people in the Harvey West area. But there was the shopkeepers are all concerned that if homeless are milling about, it's going to decrease their business, okay? Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's any studies or research that's been done that indicates that that's accurate. Nothing that I've ever seen.
No,
right. That's the primary concern, and that's why they don't want homeless people downtown, you know? And that's why there's a sleeping ban, and that's why there's a lot of discrimination in Santa Cruz against homeless persons, because basically Santa Cruz operates off of tourism. If we have all these homeless people walking around, then, you know, clearly that's going to reduce our revenue. And to me, when I was there and after I left, thinking about it, you know, that all comes to me as the bottom line, is it's really a revenue situation, and people don't want to see the revenues decline, and so they're discriminatory.
In the last few months, maybe even for a longer period of time, First Alarm Security has been employed by the Homeless Service Center to patrol the Homeless Service Center. I'm going to ask you about that. Let me see who this caller is, though.
Sure.
We may have
sure.
a question for you.
Perhaps sure.
I can put him on. Hi there, caller. Can you hear me?
Yes, Robert. I can.
And who is this?
Uncle Dennis.
Hey, Uncle Dennis. You got a question for our guest, Doug Loisel?
No, I just have a point of information for you.
Okay.
Plantronics is doing quite well. They are in no danger at all of closing down or reducing their profits. They are continuing on as a Fortune 500 company, the only one in Santa Cruz, and a major employer here in town.
Well, Dick Wilson and Wilsonism lives, even though Dick has gone into healthy retirement.
I have no love for Dick Wilson.
You don't?
No, none at all.
Oh, but, for God's sake.
Plantronics is alive and well.
Well, I appreciate the point of information. Thank you, Dennis.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So there you are. Go ahead,
yeah,
Doug.
See? He was right.
He was right. I mean, and you were both. And I don't know where I got. I think I was thinking of, I don't know, Lipton Tea or some other company that's gone out of business. I'm all these big corporations look. Of course, they're not Fortune 500 people, I guess, but they all look alike to me. You know, we had some email back and forth at the beginning of this year. I was trying to. Did you want to say something?
No. I'm just listening.
Yeah. I was trying to get information about the Homeless Service Center and records that were held by the city, and I was told they had no records regarding the Homeless Service Center. And so I sent you an email requesting some information, and you wrote me back that the Homeless Service Center receives funding from the city and county of Santa Cruz for the winter shelter, capital money, and so forth. So in other words, they seem to have lost all their records when you make a Public Records Act request, but what was your... go ahead.
That's absurd. They've got all sorts of documentation, and if they don't, then Homeless Service Center wouldn't be receiving any funding. So there's funding that is streamed through the city and the county, and then there's funding that comes directly from the city and the county. And so they've got a significant amount of records. You know, I think when I was there, we talked, and you were kind of giving me grief or putting some pressure on me. You know, why aren't you making this policy change, or why aren't you making that policy change? And I think that what I indicated to you is that I actually invited you to come over and take a look at all our financial records so that you could see exactly what we were doing. And I think that, you know, Homeless Service Center and probably, you know, nonprofits in general would do well to have a level of transparency, because, that would clarify a whole number of things for you and for the community at large and the people that you communicate to. So You know, when it comes to public records, and records in general, unless it's some sort of, you know, documentation about a client or something along those lines, I've always been of the ilk that, you know, financials should be open to the public, especially if it's a publicly funded program.
Well, you did write me that the Homeless Service Center received capital money from the city of Santa Cruz to the tune of $800,000 for the construction of the Paul Lee Loft. Called EHAP funding,
like, right.
Comes from the state.
Emergency Housing and Assistance Program.
Uh-huh. And yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, that's state money that was funneled through the city.
And you also mentioned that the Homeless Service Center rents the strip of land in which the loft, the kitchen, and the lockers were located, the day center, from either the city or the county for about $4,000 a month.
I think it was the county.
And you thought that this is going to be conveyed to the Homeless Service Center at some future time.
Right, that's correct.
And then there were... Go ahead.
Oh, no, no, I'm just listening. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I'm kind of reviewing some of our emails.
The notion that they don't have any records, that just doesn't... I can't... It's incomprehensible.
Strains credibility, that sort of thing. Yeah, for sure. And that's we have a new city clerk, or Nike's called something else now. They got a new position named Tom Graves, who initially seemed relatively accessible, but he quickly became part of the existing Dick Wilson, and now it's the Martine Bernal machine. Bernal has taken over the Wilson city manager job.
Okay.
He is the new boss of the city. And in the dark of night, devises laws to criminalize homeless protesters without even taking them to city council or to the commissions they're supposed to go through. City Hall is now a closed-off area at night. You cannot walk in there even to read the agenda.
That's what I understand. Yeah.
Similarly, the library. If you go and try to sit on a bench next to the library after 9 or 9:30, that's a trespass crime. Similarly, the police station. If you walk into the public area of the police station on the outdoor area, that's illegal late at night. An incredible restriction, not incredible, but a significant restriction and constriction of public space is happening in Santa Cruz, mostly prompted by homeless protests, which have been peaceful but provocative. You know, they're saying you're criminalizing people who are doing what they need to do, which is to sleep. Now, the segment of tape that I played you had a person that you expressed some esteem for, some regard for, Monica Martinez, making statements, at least that I've told you, are simply lies. But I guess, have you had much communication with the Homeless Service Center board or anybody there? I know they sought your expertise after they ran you out of town. But the question is, you know, do you have much sense of what they're doing other than, you know, what you hear on my highly prejudiced show?
Your highly prejudiced show is my single source of information in Santa Cruz today. So I'm probably a little bit on, biased towards you. I don't remember saying anything positive or negative about Monica. I do remember saying that I didn't know her and I didn't really know what was going on, with her. I think that was what I was conveying, unless you have something different that I wrote you in an email, which you can quote on.
Yeah, I don't have that with me here, but okay. I mean, I probably should have, you know, but I mean, I suppose we should also, you know, do the 5-minute mea culpa thing, which, you know, I don't even think has any necessity to bring up, but, you know, maybe scandal mongers are eager to hear because this is a station that's covered the city's, the smear job against you. Based
right.
upon the charges that were filed and have been dismissed, and you've gotten a not guilty verdict, and you've dealt with issues that arose around that came out of a sting operation against you from an underage woman or girl, if you will, and you had an alcohol problem at the time, none of which had any impact, and it didn't happen in Santa Cruz, happened before you came here. Correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, by the way.
No, I agree.
You know, and I mean, I remember, I mean, you, of course, you felt the weight of, you know, this, you know, outraged community sentiment about this issue. Although, you know, one has to ask who was hurt other than you and the community through losing your services. It's really hard for me to figure what went down there. I mean, I caught a lot of your mea culpa. You know, you're apologizing for your alcohol problem, and you're apologizing for, you know, the fact that they had to find someone new. And you're, apologizing for not maybe having given all this explicit discussion of this issue before you showed up here. But as far as I could see, during the 9 months you were here, it wasn't an issue at all.
No, it wasn't an issue.
I mean, you were not going, you were not hankering after young homeless women or preying on homeless mothers or abusing homeless boys or, you know, quite the contrary. You were creating conditions for people that allowed them to take a shit at night, for one thing. You did some things I didn't like. You thought you wanted to charge them for homeless meals, which I think, I don't think they're doing that now. They're charging people for laundry now, I guess.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So, any comments on any of the tirade I've just given?
No, I think that the fact that everything was dismissed and a not guilty plea was accepted is enough for me.
Good.
But thank you. I appreciate your words.
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm just trying to talk common sense to the insensible. It's always a difficulty, and well, it's not difficult. I like to talk, but it doesn't make much sense to do so. Almost, it seems.
Yeah, you were one of the few people that saw the situation very clearly. In fact, I think you were one of about two people that saw the situation clearly, and I was very appreciative of you at the time, and I'm still appreciative of you, so thank you.
Hey, you wrote me a glowing letter. Thank you.
I did. You should read that on
I should. If I need a recommendation, I'm going to whip that one out, man.
People's perception of you will completely change.
Well, you know, consider the source. Yeah, for sure, man.
True. Yeah. Right.
So what changes would you have made at the Homeless Service Center had you continued? What changes would you like to see made there? Maybe broader changes in the way the homeless are treated in Santa Cruz.
Well, I'd like to see realistic policies in place, because right now the policies are basically just discriminatory against the homeless population. They exclude the homeless population as if there's this, you call it criminalization, I call it pathologizing of the homeless population. There is very little understanding that, you know, persons who are homeless because they've been traumatized, because they suffer from an addiction, because they suffer from mental illness, because their life trajectory wasn't, a supportive elementary school, K through 12 experience moving through college and then getting a great job. I mean, these are persons who have suffered for reasons outside themselves. And I think there needs to be a general understanding that that's not criminal. And by pathologizing these folks, we create a situation where it's acceptable to exclude them rather than include them.
Let me interrupt you here, because I want to know this, the way you're describing it, makes me a little uneasy, because I'm wondering what percentage of the homeless population, in your sense, are we talking about people who are, you know, they're intrinsically damaged, they're junkies, they come from psychological problem families, and the real reason for their homelessness lies within the bad seed of themselves, or there were social conditions when they were young, but these are damaged individuals. We don't have to look at the fact that, you know, rapacious landlords and huge bank scams have produced an economy that is tanking all over the world. Rather, we just have to say, you know, focus instead on the intractable mentally ill, you know, dope them up, you know, alcohol, put them in, you know, 12-step programs, you know, and then confine them in shelter barracks. And because after all, they can't take care of themselves. Train them how to use their checkbooks. You catch my drift.
Yeah, yeah.
Percentage of the homeless are you feel there because of economic conditions that might affect, ordinary, normal individuals out there listening to this particular broadcast?
Well, one of the statistics that always kind of jumps out at me is that 24% of the homeless population are families. And I would kind of make the logical conclusion or the jump that those are persons who were at one time housed and for whatever economic conditions came about because of this recession or depression, these persons were out in the cold. There are a lot of reasons why people are homeless. one of the reasons why people are homeless is that the poor or low-income persons are two or three crises away from homelessness. So if I'm living on the margin and I have to take my children to child care to drop them off and then drive to work, and my car breaks down and I don't have any resources, I lose my job, I lose my apartment or my home, I'm homeless. So a lot of people who are, you know, not in the category that I just gave the lengthy description of, a lot of people are just, low-income working or the working poor. And those persons are one to two crises, three crises away from being on the streets. So yeah, it is also economic conditions. Does that answer your question, or is that the thought?
It kind of does. I mean, I was just wondering if you think that that's a majority of the population down there that you came into contact with, or a minority, or what?
I saw a lot of people. I can't say that it was the majority, but I saw a lot of people. I saw people with college degrees. I saw people who had gone through military service. I saw people who had lived for significant periods of time, you know, in the middle class or lower middle class, and they ended up in shelters.
So you don't have to provide people with civil rights if they're damaged individuals who need special kinds of focus. You know, these are alcoholics. These are people who are, you know, junkies. These are people who are mentally ill. And therefore, we can understand that it's okay to scoot them out of public sight and deny them access to public spaces using such things as the sleeping ban and the sitting ban and the spare changing ban and the performing ban, where the word ban means severe restrictions on any of these activities, because they're not like you and me, see? They are, you and I wouldn't be in that situation. We're not Jewish, for one thing, you know. We're not black, you know. We're not Latino. We don't have to worry about that stuff. We got good jobs for the moment, you know, that sort of thing. Or we have some kind of independent income.
Right.
And I'm just, you know, I mean, to me, the real question is, what percentage of the population, because the current mythology about homelessness is that it is some sort of individual deficiency in the person, whether it's a psychological problem or a drug problem or, some other kind of problem. It is, you know, it's not something that is created by the fact that there's huge amounts of there's no housing, or housing is a racket in this whole society. Whereas, you know, just as people's wages drop, rents rise. You know, as people's homes are foreclosed on, rents are going up. I mean, that's
right.
What's happening. I don't know what's happening in your neck of the woods.
Well, same thing here as it is there. I mean, in banks are foreclosing. Families are moving in together, and then, you know, conflicting, and then moving on to the next sofa, the next couch. Children are being brought from home to home. And again, once again, 24% of the population in Southern California is comprised of families, and it's basically because of economic, you know, conditions. I guess what I see is, I don't think of alcoholism or addiction. I think of it as a disease. I think of mental illness as a disease, and we've done a lot to demonize persons suffering from mental illness. I don't see mental illness. You know, you don't say. I can say, Robert Norris, he's schizophrenic, right? But I don't say Robert Norris, he's cancer, right? Because that doesn't, cancer, if you had cancer, God hope you don't, if I say Robert Norris is cancer, what I'm saying is his whole being is defined by his cancer. If I say Robert Norris is schizophrenic, what I'm saying is his whole being his whole being is defined by schizophrenia. What I want to say is Robert suffers from cancer. Robert suffers from schizophrenia. It's a part of his life. It's not him in total.
And we suffer from these labels that are being put upon people to essentially, you know, put them into categories that enable them to justify their being controlled and differently treated.
I agree. And I think that what happens in our society is that we use it as a tool to discriminate and to exclude because we feel uncomfortable because it's different from us.
We're talking with Doug Loisel. I mean, don't go ahead. I'm going to interrupt you for a minute. We're talking with Doug Loisel, who's currently, I guess, in Southern California. And where are you anyway?
Well, whereabouts unknown.
He's hiding in Southern California. Get him.
Yeah, I'm on the lam.
He's down there somewhere in the greater Los Angeles area. He's a former Homeless Service Center executive director. And you can call in with questions and comments at 427-3772, if you'd like to ask some questions, make some comments, challenge some of the statements either of us have said, raise some other issues you think are pertinent. Again, 831-427-3772. And go ahead with what you were saying, Doug. I wanted to give
up. People feel uncomfortable with things that are different, you know, whether it's a different a race, sometimes we feel different gender, different social status, and certainly people feel uncomfortable. Many people feel uncomfortable with homeless persons because they see them as being different. I describe them as having obstacles to integrating into society as a whole, but I certainly don't see them as any different from me.
I'm going to jump away from this endless... I mean, I've heard this kind of talk so many times. I'm really not interested. It's not your fault. But, I mean, what specific recommendations do you have for the city of Santa Cruz? Because you were here for 9 months. You had a pretty on-the-ground view of what was needed. What radical changes or cosmetic changes need to be made here to deal with not just the housing situation of homeless people, which I think is what they really need, but in the meantime, because nobody's going to snap their fingers and provide housing for people, what should activists be working to change here in Santa Cruz? What should social service providers be standing up and saying, we need this change here and we need it now? What changes would you recommend?
Well, first thing that needs to happen is there needs to be more dialogue between and have homeless persons actually represented on panels with the police, with the city council, with HUF, and there needs to be an open and realistic discussion of what's really going on, because nobody really talks. Nobody else talks about what's really going on, and they need homeless service center and the River Street shelter. That's a nice little facility, and that's a token facility because it doesn't even begin to meet the needs of the homeless population. They need to open up larger warehouse-type programs. There's a Salvation Army Bell Shelter. It houses 300 people. It does it in a relatively large area, but it was unused warehouse space. There's a lot of unused warehouse space. They need to open up these facilities for people so that they can be safe. And I recommend harm reduction models where people don't have to be tested for drugs and alcohol before they go into the shelter, because truthfully, I feel like that's discriminatory as well. So I would advocate opening up large shelters, efficiently run, clean beds, some level of medical services, maybe once a week or twice a week. And I would advocate that they be harm reduction models, where people have opportunity to stay there even if they are under the influence. Doesn't it make more sense for them to be in a controlled environment than wandering around the streets? I wouldn't advocate use inside the building, but the fact that people... There's a program up in Canada where they give
injection centers,
there,
yeah. And in Europe. In Europe they have injection and inhalation centers for cocaine, methadrine, heroin users. I don't know about actually methadrine, but I know about heroin and cocaine, I believe. You could go there and, use your stuff in controlled circumstances. So
what you have now is you have the homeless population up in the Poganip and down by the river, where it's intensely unsafe. If they're not going to allow these people to be sheltered, can't you create an area that these folks can sleep, that there is some level of monitoring so no violence occurs.
Another concern of an activist, David Silva, who calls into our show frequently, just got back into town. David,
yeah, I heard him.
You heard?
Last night. Yeah.
He's quite articulate and also quite passionate.
Right.
And he's in his late 60s. He described how, you remember, in the kitchen when he, you know, because he's HIV positive and a person living with AIDS, he didn't want to, you know, go work in the kitchen because he felt that would be inappropriate. You know, he wanted to make sure people were safe. And he was actually assaulted, abused by the Homeless Service Center staff for being that way when he signed up for the Homeless Service Center programs, according to his account. Even though he had signed the schedule, there were those who felt they had seniority and they'd been there longer. They were the old timers, even though they didn't have to sign up. They had their connections with, you know, Nancy Liu or Daniel, whoever was running the joint. Did you have those kinds of problems when you were there?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you have people. I mean, those are people problems. Those are problems of perception and not having all the information. And, yeah, of course we had those problems. And you kind of deal with those on a, you know, one-on-one basis. Yeah, I just thought of five problems that we had. One guy wanted to bring a dog on campus, and we had the problem with all the bicycles on the campus, people, you know, riding their bicycles in circles around the campus. And so we stopped a few of those things because they were health and safety issues. Personally, I would never have stopped anybody working in the kitchen who suffered from HIV. That's not how that disease is communicated.
Well, remember, he wasn't stopped from working in the kitchen. He tried to say, I don't want to, you know, cause a problem by working in the kitchen with HIV because it might not be safe. Because, you know, I might have an accident.
Right.
They wanted to force him to work in the kitchen.
As
I understand it, that was his claim as to what happened. He also claimed that because he was half an hour late in getting back to the Paul Lee Loft because he had a medical appointment and he called in and told them he was going to be late, they put him out and his diabetic partner, and they wouldn't let Nancy Liu Biscotti refused to respond to any phone calls, and they had no appeals process that he could use. Is there an appeals process that was in place when you were there?
You know, the appeals process works like this. You talk to your case manager. If you're not satisfied, you talk to their manager. Not satisfied, talk to the associate director. Not satisfied, talk to the executive director. I talked with a lot of clients who worked their way up the chain, and it wasn't arduous, and there was no obstacles in the way. I have no, you know, you have to say you have to like people to do that job. If you don't really like people or you're using it as a vehicle for something else, it's probably not the right job for you. For me, it felt like it was the right job because I always found people's stories fascinating. I feel like one of my things that all my staff knew was that we treat everybody with dignity and respect. And, you know, I felt like it was a really rich experience for me. And so this idea of an ivory tower and, you know, I'm not going to be accessible, I don't think that you're going to be making decisions that are going to increase a person's quality of life if you use that philosophy.
You know, it sounds like you were not, and frankly my experience of you was as a person who did seem to enjoy his work, who didn't mind talking with people like myself who were perhaps considered pariahs by some of the establishment figures in the...
You only scared me at first for about two or three times we met, and then I calmed down.
Oh, ho. So yeah. I lost my touch, huh? Oh,
well, I got to know you're actually a nice guy.
Oh, boy. Well, you appearances can be deceiving. You know, watch out for me.
I know, I do.
Yeah. So, we have on the line here Doug Loisel from way down south, former Homeless Service Center director. And we got about 10 minutes left in the show. If anybody wants to call in and put a question or two on the table, 831-427-3772, 427-3772. Now is your chance. And it's kind of a rare opportunity because Doug doesn't often, you know, you called in a couple times before, I think, on this show. But, you know, this is, I think it's, well, it's good to hear you anyway. Let me put it that way. But, you know, I haven't got a lot more questions lined up. Is there something you want to say in response to, I guess you said you were talking about opening up a warehouse, treating people like human beings. I mean, you know, what does that mean? You know, finding people who like their jobs, putting people on, homeless people on the panels for greater dialogue and discussion. What about substantive specific changes in ordinances and laws? Do you have anything to say about that? I know often when I talk to former homeless service center staff or directors, they'd say, oh, we can't talk about that. We're just social service providers. We're not homeless advocates, you know. So.
Well, yeah, and I think that was my cop-out when I was up there with you. I kept saying, you know, you have your role, I have my role. But, you know, now that I don't have a role anymore, you know, they need, I don't know if they need to completely abolish the sleeping ban, but they need to figure out places for people to sleep that are safe. And, you know, you can have areas that are available. You know, I don't necessarily think you need everybody all over the place because that's not safe.
We got a caller. Let me jump him in there.
Sure.
Hi there. You're on Free Radio with Doug and Robert.
I wanted to congratulate the Free Radio diviners for relocating the emanations pending.
Oh, wait a minute. Are you actually getting this on the air?
What's that?
You're not really getting the Free Radio.
No, I heard from you that you found a new location.
That's what that's the scuttlebutt.
I wanted to enthusiastically congratulate the
Fair enough, circle. Fair enough. Thank you. Is that it?
Well, when is your guest coming back to Santa Cruz?
I don't know. Are you planning to come back to Santa Cruz? And if so, will you be bringing a gun with you, Doug?
I don't know. No guns and, yeah, so if somebody's willing to give me a job, I'd be back.
Jobs are kind of hard to come by up here. I think that the McDonald's, supposedly, they always tell you, oh, you can go get a job at McDonald's. I don't see
right.
a lot of help wanted signs at McDonald's, but then I haven't been down there lately.
When I've been applying for jobs like McDonald's, the doctorate comes into place and, you know, it's like raises eyebrows.
Overqualified. So, overqualified.
Yeah, well, why are you applying for this position? Because, you know, I fucked my life up. So.
No, because you need rent money is why you're applying for this position.
Right.
Now, you got to stop
right.
this temptation to beat yourself up there, Doug. You know,
yeah.
Otherwise, I'll come down and beat you up myself.
And you could. I have no doubt.
Well, I'm going to work on maybe I'll hit you on down there. Bob, anything else you want to ask or suggest?
How old is Doug?
Doug,
I'm 49.
Well, you're not dead yet, right?
No, not dead yet.
Okay, so you have at least a couple of years to be hanging out.
Yeah.
So whatever happens, something will happen.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah. Are you, do you have like a flow going?
A flow?
Yeah.
I don't understand that.
Well, do you have any kind of other than just keep other than tumultuousness? You know, and one disaster after another, is there some kind of a flow where you feel like at ease?
Are you talking about a psychic flow or a financial flow?
Well, both, because they're wrapped. I mean, we have to survive.
Well,
and whether you want it, whatever you want to call it, these...
I can comment on that. Yeah, I do. I'm learning, I think my narcissism is melting away slowly, very slowly. And I'm learning that...
narcissism meaning self-love?
Selfish, severe self-love.
You have a PhD?
Self-obsession.
PhD in what?
Clinical psychology.
Political psychology.
Clinical psychology.
Clinical psychology.
Yeah.
So you know a psychotic from psychosis?
I do.
Can you tell a psychotic city council is my question.
Well, if you know a psychotic from psychosis, then you know what a tautology is.
Yeah.
This better go somewhere. I'm cutting this one off.
I just wanted to restate a congratulations to the inner circle for scoring a landing.
Sure. Thank you, Bob.
All the best.
All right, man. Bye-bye.
Thank you. So, So were we talking about what we would do?
Yeah, specifics, specifics. What should this shitty council be doing here? That you, maybe you've seen maybe you suggested inhalation. Well, I think they should have inhalation and injection centers for people to use, and I think they should have places for homeless people to come as well. It's, you might say, well, these are impossible, you know, notions. They're so far advanced of their times. I couldn't care less. I think you've got to propose what is realistic and real in the sense of what is needed, not so much what is politically possible.
Well, I see it completely the opposite. Right now, Santa Cruz is just grinding its wheels and going nowhere.
Huh.
You know, I mean, Santa Cruz is doing nothing. They're not solving the problem. They're exasperating the problem. They're creating more problem. They're expending more money. And instead of having a comprehensive, you know, 5-year plan where they say, okay, we're going to commit these resources, we're going to build this area out, we're going to provide this park, you know, there's plenty of parks. We're going to build this park. We're going to get this building. We're going to have this harm reduction model and bring in people who know what they're doing and have an idea about what they're going to do. Instead of trying to dislodge the homeless are going to be in Santa Cruz. So let's create a situation where everybody works together. And if that's not archaic or some sort of radical thought, that's just a realistic way to look at a problem and solve it. I don't understand. There's plenty of room in... My thing is that people in groups can be monitored more easily, and there is violence that goes on in homeless groups, and having some sort of, not necessarily police presence, but some sort of structure will reduce violence and will increase quality of life. And it'll do away with this whole sleeping ban nuisance. I got to go to a homeless service center to get my letter.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. We've almost reached the end of our time here because we've got about 2 minutes and Uncle Dennis is arriving in the studio here to bounce me for the fluffy, puffy music show that follows mine from the cream to the dregs. I think we should, maybe I could come up with some more specifics from you on, I'm really looking at some particular, looking to get some particular sense of what needs to change here politically. I mean, you know, we've had all kinds of 10-year plans to end homelessness. I'm really tired of that stuff because it's obviously horseshit. And they're paying money to people to spend their time babbling away and act like they're doing something. But I'm afraid we're running out of time. I'm going to give you the last word here, and then I'm going to sign off pretty quick.
Okay.
Unless you have nothing you want to say.
Yeah. No. What needs to change is the mentality that these people are bad people, and we want to somehow harass them or frustrate them out of our community, because that's only creating problems and it's only creating this consternation among everybody. It's not going to work, and so there has to be some sort of compromise and a plan in place by somebody who can actually get the job done.
And you could be the man to do it. And I think we need you as an executive director of the infamous Homeless Service Center. However, unfortunately, I'm not doing the hiring. So
see what you can do, Robert. You have pull.
I will move in and see if I can get Monica to resign in favor of you.
Okay.
I think it will be a step forward, at least in some ways.
Hey, can I say hi to my son Matthew and his fiancée Brittany?
Why not?
They moved up to Monterey and they're getting married on October 22nd. So he's listening tonight, so I told him I'd say hi.
Hey, beware. Marriage can be, well, we won't get into that at this time.
Yeah, that's next program.
All right.
All right.
Nothing whatsoever except what I see around me. That's frightening enough. Thank you, Doug. We're talking with Doug Loisel. All right, man.
Bye-bye. It was really a pleasure to talk to you again. And call me on that other stuff. We'll get that done, too.
I will.
Okay. Thanks Robert.
And that was Doug Loisel, former Homeless Service Center Executive Director.
If you've got questions for him that you weren't able to ask, if you email them to me at rnorse3@hotmail.com, I will pass them on to him. rnorse3@hotmail.com. That's all for Bathrop Spears Broadsides.
Really?
Unfortunately, as you can hear, we have another voice, another presence has entered the studio with questionable and archaic musical who knows what going on. So I'm going to have to get out of here before I start tapping my feet and humming along. You never can tell what's going to happen next here in Free Radio. But
that would be unique, Robert.
But I know Bob LaMonica was interested, Dennis, in knowing, is there really a likelihood that Free Radio will go back on the air? Is it possible?
It is possible.
But it's not necessarily likely?
It'll happen in the next hour.
What about the next week?
Probably not.
Probably not in the next week. Okay, I've been a little too optimistic. But should be happening fairly soon, we hope.
We have some significant issues to overcome before we go back on the air, but we're working toward them.
Okay, so what do we need from the community that can help resolve these issues? Money? Is this some sort of panhandling on the stream here? Is that what this is?
Well, we have to build a transmitter shack.
Right.
And so we need plywood and 2x4s, and you know, we need them this Saturday.
And how much money is needed to complete the shack?
I don't know. It depends on how much is donated. If materials get donated, then we don't have to buy them.
And if you have to buy them, how much would it be?
Probably around $150.
So all you angels out there, either bring your plywood down or else kick down cash. Is that the suggestion?
Yeah.
All righty. Well, then I'm going to...
Plywood, 2x4s, that's what we need Saturday.
Hmm. Well, then... and it could be that as of Saturday, Sunday, there will be a 101.1 FM free radio?
No.
Why not? That's when my show comes on again, Sunday morning, 9:30, Dennis.
We still need a DSL line there. We have to move the stuff out of the old transmitter location. We've got to put the antenna up in the tree. None of that's happening.
Well, get to work, Dennis. What are we paying you for? This guy is impossible.
You want to talk about how much I'm getting paid?
I won't get into that at this time. However,
how much effort Uncle Dennis has put into Free Radio over the last 14 years?
Uncle Dennis is actually he's long of tooth and long of hair as well. Well, not as long as some, let's put it that way. Anyway, yeah, do get in touch with Free Radio, freakradio.org, on the stream.
FRSC@freakradio.org.
Really? FRSC@freakradio.org. That should be posted here, but no, nobody ever posts it here. Well, it isn't there, is it?
No, it should be there.
It should be, I agree. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, you can call 423-HUFF. Oh, come on, Dennis. You have no trouble getting in touch with me if you want. 423-4833.
335 what?
No. 423-4833. There you go.
335 what?
No.
I don't know because I lost my phone.
You're
I don't have your cell phone.
Pay no attention to the voice in the background, except that you'll have to if you're going to continue listening because Uncle Dennis is going to come at you with some creamy, dreggy stuff. Thanks for being with me, though, on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides.